This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 3rd of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 265 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up, we head to Nairobi to look at China's expanding role in Africa with veteran foreign correspondent Howard French.
Then an unassuming house in North London once hosted a vast collection of books, along with some of the world's most famous left-wing intellectuals. We'll take a tour.
And we dive down a gonzo rabbit hole of big money in American politics with Politico's Kenneth Fogel.
All that and some great music too, all coming up here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Maybe, Andrew, we should have a new policy, a bit like they used to have on a Ryanair flight. Other low-budget carriers are available. Apparently when they used to land, they used to have a little sort of siren or a big bell would ring in the plane over the tannoy system in the plane saying, well, we've landed safely. Maybe we should do that for the issue.
Because the issue has just landed. Has it landed or taken off safely?
I think it's... I don't know.
Anyway. The new issue
September
left,
has landed.
Left the door on Friday.
Phew. It's all right. Actually, I thought it was all right. I quite enjoyed this one. I liked it. I say I don't enjoy all of them, but I mean, you know.
But it's been a little while because, well, it's a double issue. You have kind of an 8-week gap between doing the actual magazine, even though we do the newspaper and
Mediterraneo.
but yes. And it's our entrepreneurs issue. So it's always a nice issue to do because it's one of those issues that actually really kind of changes people's lives, it does.
What I like about the entrepreneurs issue is, exactly. It's changed my life.
Why, are you going to start a business?
Exactly.
No, but it's good. It's like the number of people who read that issue and then write to you and say, do you know what? I've decided I'm going to do it.
I used to be, I used to be on Wall Street and now I've moved to Mantua to make shoes.
They do.
That was Daniel Day-Lewis, wasn't it?
They do, after they've read Monocle. You watch out.
What are we saying this time? Are we saying you should move to Mantua and make shoes? You should buy a couple of llamas? Buy a little prairie in Peru?
You get a llama free with each issue. That's how we're delivering them this issue.
Man alive, I love a llama. I went to the Rare Breeds show at the Wild and Downland Museum, Open Air Museum in Sussex a couple of weeks ago. And they have all the sort of the cows and pigs and goats and sheep and things you'd expect to find there. But they also have modern animals, or what we think of modern animals, which are probably really ancient. They're probably older, sort of, sort of etymologically than all these other things.
What's a modern animal? Give me an example.
A llama. I mean, a contemporary farm animal.
Oh, okay.
Outside of its, of what you might think of it is its a natural habitat. A llama. They're amazing animals. They look like if a child, if you gave a child a piece of paper and a pencil and said, draw like an amazing fantasy animal that isn't like a Pegasus or something, I think it would be a llama. It sort of looks like a child's drawing of an animal. It's amazingly cute. Long eyelashes.
But they're quite big though, aren't they?
I think they did have baby llamas, which were the ones I really liked.
I think they can spit and kick.
Who can't?
Especially if they go out for a few beers of an evening.
Exactly. I think this is probably the best point in the programme to bring in the one and only Tom Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, please make yourselves at home. It's Sunday. It's midday. Live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Welcome to the show, Tom Edwards. How's your week been?
It's been great. How are you both?
Well, I'm all right, aren't I? Look at me.
You look in rude health.
I'm in ruddy health.
You've had a haircut.
Yeah, I have my haircut. That's good. I had a sort of pre-Monocle Weekly haircut.
That's good to prepare that way.
Admittedly, some of our guests are on the telephone line, but we can't get everyone into the studio. It doesn't mean standards should slip.
No, you need to look the part.
I mean, I'm obviously still wearing...
What part is he playing? No, don't look sad, Rob. I retract that.
Do you know what happens?
Playing the part of a leading man.
Exactly.
Do you know what happens when I go and have my hair cut? Two things happen.
Tell me what happens.
First of all, it makes me go to sleep. I went to sleep three times.
It's very relaxing.
Oh,
it's fine.
Man, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's then difficulty if your barber likes to chat.
And still just straight off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you paint eyelids on your eyes? I mean, eyes on your eyelids.
They've just come to accept it by now.
Are they? Get that grumpy one in again.
Yeah, it's not grumpy. No. I just tell them at the outset, I'll probably nod off, and then away you go.
Boom. Are you a magazine reader when you have your haircut? Oh, or are you a...
Well, it's a very difficult time.
Where are you going on your holidays?
Well, because I wear glasses.
Yeah.
And obviously you have to take off your glasses when you go for a haircut.
I suppose you do, don't you? Yeah.
And then I really can't see, so I'm beholden to them. You're trusting them.
Yeah, that's a big trust. It's a lot.
And it's like, pop your glasses back on at the end, and sometimes it's like, oh my God.
The thing I don't like is when they say, do you want a coffee or a drink while you're having your haircut? Who wants a coffee in their hand while bits of hair flying all over the place?
There's so much hair as well.
Yeah.
It would go in the coffee, wouldn't it?
Yeah, don't like that.
No, I think I've still got some hairs between my teeth. I'm sure they're from that. Let's, moving swiftly on.
Oh, dear.
Where are we going to, Robert?
I don't know, probably some really serious news thing.
No, this is kind of serious. I mean, it's a bit of a media story, and I was wondering whether we should commence with this, given our international outlook. But
yeah.
I thought this does genuinely have sort of wider implications. On Wednesday of this week, Andy Coulson will appear in court facing perjury charges in Scotland. Now, this is all to do with the Tommy Sheridan trial,
which,
I don't know if you remember, during that appeals process for that original trial, Tommy Sheridan had claimed that his phone was hacked, and Coulson was giving evidence and was asked whether any other hacking had happened, and he stuck very rigidly to this one rogue reporter defence that he subsequently used when he was on trial himself over phone hacking. And obviously he's subsequently been convicted at the court here in London, and therefore his evidence now questionable from the Sheridan trial. And it's just like the sort of ongoing, this sort of sore of in the sort of media scene in this country.
And he's currently in jail anyway, isn't he?
He's in jail presently. Now, what I'm not exactly sure about is whether they can kind of tack on a bit more of a sentence should he be found guilty of perjury, which, without wishing to prejudice the proceedings, it does seem like it could well happen, given the fact of his conviction.
But that's an interesting one as well, when you're tried in two separate legal entities.
Well, I think he may need to go and serve a separate sentence in a Scottish prison, possibly.
That'd be pretty bad, wouldn't it? You come out of the English one, and they're like, oh, hang on a sec, you just get in this coach and come up to Edinburgh, and you get tried again, you have to go into two for the price of one.
Exactly. But it's interesting, and obviously a lot of people are still speculating about how high up the chain of command within, you know, the whole news international organisation. People knew, some people are unconvinced, despite the acquittal of other, you know, members of that team who were subsequently cleared recently. And it's going to also great for David Cameron, one imagines, because, of course, he hired Coulson after he left this institution to work in number 10 Downing Street. So it's going to be more awkward questions, one imagines, for him to face too.
Okay, well, that cheered us up. Next.
Well, this is slightly more upbeat. Let's keep it Scottish. Why not? It's a bit of a kind of UK bonanza.
Yeah.
The Edinburgh Festival. Now, I know this is UK-centric, but such a great event and of global significance.
That because we had a guest on the other day from the Edinburgh International Festival.
That's
on the
right.
Monocle Weekly.
Was that Jonathan Mills?
Yes,
yeah.
It was.
Yeah, Jonathan. I thought I remember hearing from him.
Sir Jonathan Mills.
Yeah, so this is his final hurrah in the director's sort of chair. But all sorts happening, as you can imagine.
I've never been.
Oh, Andrew, that's
actually,
just terrible.
I've never been either.
It's really excellent. They got Ladysmith Black Mambazo this year.
Oh, yeah.
What's not to enjoy?
Oh, what? I will lay that, etc.
It's like that.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
And let's move along.
Okay, what about this, something that's slightly more ridiculous? What about Elvis Week?
Okay.
And obviously you've got 50,000 people, they do a vigil at Graceland, there's all sorts of capers that go on. Apparently there's a karate tournament.
Why?
No one knows why. but that's something to enjoy. Elvis impersonators, Rob, I can imagine you could do a bit of a...
Okay.
That doesn't work on the radio either, does it?
Like... No, don't do that. It's a bit of a kind of like a shoulder movement.
Looks like you are the man that instigated Karate Week as part of
maybe that's what it was all about.
Yeah. I like Comeback Elvis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I like Comeback
Elvis. That's controversial.
Yeah. I mean, I like, you know, all the periods are great. I don't like super crazy fat Elvis. I like sort of good-looking sort of 73
Early
Elvis.
Vegas.
So, yeah, CBS Comeback Show, LP era. I think that's
pretty
the one.
Good.
That's the one, yeah.
And one final thing today, and I was meaning to bring in something so you could actually sample this on this day of all days, because it's Watermelon Day today. No, listen, this is good.
Okay.
This is all about raising the awareness of the health benefits of
They're very
of
hydrating,
watermelon.
Aren't they?
Well, they're a superfood.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Okay.
But there's a few of them, aren't there? You can get those superfoods.
But isn't it one of those foods that you eat that's got more, you use more calories to eat it than there are in it? It's just water, isn't it?
Is it?
No.
It's just water.
No, come on, Andrew. It provides 80% of your vitamin C, just for starters. Really? Potassium, fibre, beta-carotene.
Yeah, but I don't
even know what that is.
I don't think you can get fat if you eat just watermelons.
No, if you ate loads of them, because that was all going to go somewhere, you'd get those big fat ankles. but there's lots of ways that you can mark the occasion. This is what I had wanted to institute today. So one of the most popular is a pip-spitting contest.
Whoa.
So I was going to open one of these.
Yeah.
And let you fire a few in. But I forgot to bring my watermelon.
Oh, damn, I can't believe that's really annoying. That would have been a great game.
I know, I'm sorry.
And Tyler would be really happy when he came back in here to do a show and it was filled
just
up with watermelon pips.
With watermelon pips.
And maybe there's like a little watermelon tree growing in the corner where someone hasn't, where Sally hasn't hoovered up well enough.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that would have been good.
That feature could have eclipsed all the other features in the show.
I think that would have been something special.
Yeah.
Maybe should I try and find some kind of fruit-based entertainment for next
maybe
week?
It could be Gooseberry Week or something next week. I'm not here next week after.
I'll find something juggleable or throwable.
Yeah.
Kumquat always comes in handy.
Well, you laugh because...
I don't know why that was funny.
No, but a kumquat is like, ooh, nice.
You got to watch out for a kumquat.
You got to watch for it. Are they the ones that are sticky?
No, they're like the smallest orange you've ever seen.
With the, and they have the brown leaves, yes. Little brown leaves wilting.
That's another thing. I think so. I think that's a kind of berry thing. But the kumquat is like literally the smallest orange you've ever seen.
What about lychee?
To silence. Did you hear that? Lychee. Silence.
That's like it,
that was a moment.
That was a moment.
Fresh, nice, canned. No. Yeah, my opinion.
You got to respect that.
Okay.
Tom, I loved all of those things. My favourite actually was Watermelon Week, but I wish that, or actually maybe it was Elvis Week. I don't know.
Maybe I'll try and go out and see, even though it's Sunday lunchtime, if I can get a watermelon. I'll bring it back for the end of the programme.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good.
I'll do my best.
Okay. Tom Edwards, thank you very much for your news look ahead.
In terms of sheer economic and cultural importance, there are few international relationships more geopolitically significant, misunderstood, or for some alarming than that of China and Africa. And there are few people better placed to crack open this relationship than our first guest today.
Howard French is a veteran foreign correspondent and served globally as bureau chief of the New York Times, including West Africa and Central Africa, and also in Shanghai. His new book, China's Second Continent, How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa, has been labelled by one reviewer as the most lush, fair and expansive look at Sino-African relations written so far.
I spoke to Howard a little bit earlier on in Nairobi. Howard, perhaps we could describe, you know, what is really going on with China in Africa. In your book, you contemplate whether this is them almost building a new kind of empire. And after all your travels around Africa, was that the conclusion that you came to, that this is actually not just about trade, this is about much more than that?
So we can take this question in two parts, if you will. One is the definition of empire, which I think has been enormously flexible over time. The history of empire is quite long, as you would know, and it has involved everything from frank direct rule via colonies to spheres of influence to concession zones and to trade empires. So China is not trying to repeat anything in the immediate past, but is trying instead, I think, to carve out an economic sphere for itself in which it is servicing its own needs in a variety of ways, not just in natural resources, which is what everyone tends to look at first, but also in terms of building markets for the future. Africa is the fastest growing demographically part of the world at present. It also happens to be economically the fastest growing part of the world, but Africa's population will triple by the end of the century to be about 3 billion people. And if things go even reasonably well economically for Africa, that means gigantic markets for China in the future at a time when the West will have shrunken demographically, and the West is, of course, very heavily debt-laden. So China's thinking about its place in a very different global economic structure down the road, several decades ahead.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, much of the engagement that's happening on the ground amongst Africans and Chinese people is among actually quite low-level migration from China. You know, these are people who are trading. You meet somebody who's running a brothel. You meet people involved in forestry, in mining, all sorts of areas. This isn't, you know, high-level people only coming into the continent. Is that migration from China something that's being encouraged officially at ground level in China? Are the authorities saying, this is, you know, again, a bit like old empire, we need to have our people on the ground?
It's something that has been encouraged but has not been directed in any very explicit or immediate way. In the middle of the 1990s, China devised a new strategy for economic expansion called going out, in which it said that China could not simply be the recipient of foreign investment and the factory of the world, but that China had to go out and conquer markets of its own and seek business and have its corporations cut their teeth in expanding developing markets. And so China in 1996 identified Africa as a priority area for this next wave of Chinese growth and expansion. And once it did that, Beijing set the provinces of China in competition with each other to seek markets in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world. And what this meant concretely is that each province has typically very big engineering and construction companies, which are state-owned companies. And they were set in competition with each other for business in Africa. And as they competed, they would send, as building large projects, roads, airports, things like that, 100, 500, sometimes 2,000 workers at a time into the African environment. And some of these people, obviously very ordinary working class type Chinese people, at the end of their contracts, say a year or two, decided that they liked it in Africa, that they saw great opportunity for themselves there and decided to stay behind. These ordinary Chinese people, these laborers, then some of them begin to succeed and stories of their success start to filter back to China. And a second wave begins to take place, which I think is even more important. And that's what I call the emulation wave, where people hear about their neighbor who they didn't necessarily have the highest opinion of to begin with, has struck it rich somewhere in Africa, in some previously unheard of place for themselves. And this plants the seed of an idea in their head where they say, wow, you know, if neighbor Joe can make it in Africa, well, I can make it in Africa too. And so through emulation, nobody has statistics on this, but perhaps for every one worker who went with a state company, 3, 5, or even 10 Chinese people have been drawn by their example, and they tend to be ordinary people.
Now, give some examples of how that range of connection is going, because in some of the instances you describe, you know, what happens is when, you know, Chinese meets African, they kind of don't get on. I think there's one instance where the Chinese people are describing the Africans as peasants, you know, as thieves. There's a description of, you know, building this amazing building and everything that gets stolen. And there's a sense that, you know, of, you know, I guess, again, very big echoes from the old days of colonialism where two sides didn't quite understand each other. But in other instances, you chart actually really kind of fruitful relationships. After you've been to Liberia, to Mozambique, to Ghana, to Senegal, what was your kind of lasting impression of how that relationship is developing?
Well, I think it's fairly typical in any kind of imperial relationship that the party that comes from the would-be empire tends to have an air of superiority about themselves. They come with a sense of mission about their own personal destiny and about a kind of hierarchy or structure, order in the world where they place themselves, you know, high in the scheme of things and the people who they are coming to settle or settle among lower in the scheme of things. I think the Chinese are absolutely typical in this regard. The fortunate thing is that, you know, a great many of the subjects that I met gradually begin to shed some of these stereotypes. And this is, you know, I don't want to paint this as being some kind of benign or enlightened phenomenon. It's maybe nothing more than the fact that you realize if you're a business person or you're trying to make it as an entrepreneur who's pulled up your stakes in China, that if you don't find a way to understand the locals, after all, whose country this is, if you can't figure out a way to get along with them and to communicate with them and to sort of meet them at their wavelength, you're probably not going to succeed. And so, you know, as you said, I did meet a great many Chinese people who, I mean, there are many instances of ugly relationships and racist language and things like that. But at the same time, there were many people who figured out along the way that, you know, there's common humanity that unites us and that if nothing else, my need for my opportunity here to succeed commands me to try to establish a rapport with the people who I have come to settle among.
And what about the morality question? I know that there's a bit when you're in Ghana and you describe how, you know, the US is seen to be active there, you know, via things like US aid. But what happens is, you know, that it's seen as a very kind of, you know, a judgmental voice. It's telling people how to run the country, you know, what they need to do about HIV, how they need to have more transparent government. And here you have the Chinese coming in saying, Yeah, we might not spend as much money on kind of HIV work, for example, but we're going to give you these shiny new buildings and we're not going to ask any questions about how you run your country. Surely there's no way that, you know, again, that the West or the US can ever compete in that sense. If, you know, if you have two offers of cash and one of them comes with no strings attached, that's always the one you're going to take, isn't it?
That's true to a certain extent, although there is growing skepticism on the ground in many African countries that I encountered with the nature of the Chinese proposition. African states will always take the choice that you described. However, African peoples look at these deals and say, these deals aren't necessarily always good deals for us. And they are deals that come with great amounts of pocket lining by the people in power that are used to sort of help them in their electoral campaigns and are made on dubious grounds. They look at these deals with the Chinese that come with typically no or very few strings attached, and they say, you know, how does this really benefit us? We have committed 20 years of a particular natural resource to the construction of a project entirely by Chinese energy, Chinese design, Chinese materials, Chinese workers. There's been no transfer of technology or know-how, and over the next 20 years, conceivably, our supply of cobalt or bauxite or uranium or timber or what have you will be exhausted. The Chinese will have delivered on their end, having given us the bridge or the highway system or the port or the airports or whatnot. But these are things with very finite lives. And if we haven't, as Africans, understood how to move up our value chain so that we can engineer, repair, maintain these sorts of things in the future ourselves, then we've surrendered a perishable natural resource, which is the basis of our economy, for something that won't even last 20 years. A road in a tropical environment, you know, typically washes out within 7 or 10 years if it's not maintained and periodically rebuilt. So I think Africans are awakening to some of the dubious basis of this Chinese proposition as well. But to speak to the Western side of your question, I would say that the problem here is that the West has seen, and particularly the United States, has seen Africa for too long as a two-dimensional entity, a place of security concerns and an arena for humanitarian action. And the West, and particularly the United States, has failed to see Africa as an economic environment. And Africans are caught up right now in a moment of great change economically. And they understand that the West comes with this attitude, and it turns them off, and it disadvantages the West or those in the West who would like to engage with the continent economically, because the West has acquired this sort of reputation based on a pattern of obsession with security and obsession with the humanitarian dimension of things. There's a very powerful argument, I think, to be made, which is that, yes, governance is important. Yes, human rights is important. Anyone who's read me over the years knows that I believe those two things. However, perhaps the best way to improve the lot of Africans, including in governance, is to assure that the pie gets bigger, that incomes rise, that wealth is spread in a relatively equitable way throughout societies. And until the West learns how to play that game, how to speak that language, and how to engage on that level, I think it's really wrestling with one arm tied behind its back in Africa.
That was Howard French on his new book, China's Second Continent, How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa. And he was speaking to us from Nairobi.
It's time for some new music now. This is from an upcoming album by our mates at Bahamas. I should say our mates, it's actually one guy, Afi Yuvanen. And this is from the new album called Bahamas is Afi. This is All the Time.
I got all the time in the world. Don't you want some of that?
All the time from the upcoming record New from Bahamas.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Time now for a tale of books, 20,000 to be exact. For decades, in an unassuming house around the corner from Hampstead Heath in North London, Shimon and Miriam Abramsky tended to their vast collection of books, manuscript, journals and writings, while also playing host to some of the most famous icons of the world's left-wing intelligentsia.
Shimon and Miriam's grandson is Sasha Abramsky, a British-born, California-based freelance journalist and author whose most recent book was The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Sasha's now dived into his past and brought the incredible story of his family to life.
The book is The House of 20,000 Books, and Sasha joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the programme.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So I love the idea of this. Was this an obsession or an interest, this books thing?
I think it was something of an obsession. My granddad, from the 1930s on in, had scoured the world's secondhand bookstores and he'd gone after every catalogue he could find. And he had these twinned interests. He was fascinated by socialist and revolutionary history, and he was fascinated by the world of Judaism and the history of Judaism. And so he managed to, over 75 years almost of collecting, to bring these two obsessions together. And anything of worth in that field would end up in his house. So you'd find in that house the membership card of the First International that Karl Marx had. And then you'd find in the house first edition Spinoza's. And then you'd find in the house 700- and 800-year-old manuscript fragments. And somehow he would bring this all together. And I think he saw it as a jigsaw puzzle. And I've spoken to a lot of collectors over the years, and they talk about their collection as putting the pieces of this puzzle together. And in a way, they're the only ones who can see what the picture is. They're the only ones who can see how that puzzle is going to look when it finishes. But I think he was absolutely obsessed by the world of words.
And tell us about them. Who were they, and what was their background, and what were their involvements?
Well, my granddad was born in just outside Minsk in Belarus, and his father, Yeheskel Abramsky, was a very, very famous rabbi. And the family, through a series of complicated events, ended up in London in the early 1930s. And my great-grandfather ended up head of the Beth Din, the Jewish religious court in London. So he was one of the most important figures in religious Judaism in Europe. And Shimon was a tiny man. He was about 5'1". Spoke with an extraordinary accent. I wouldn't even dream of trying to replicate it because it was unreproducible, but just this very, very thick, musty Eastern European accent. And he became a communist in the 1930s. My grandmother grew up in the East End of London, and her family ran a Jewish bookstore in the East End right by Petticoat Lane. And they met in 1940. Shimon had come back from what was then Palestine. He was studying at the Hebrew University. And he came back and he got stranded by World War II and he needed a job. And he ended up working in the bookstore and he met the bookstore's owner, Mimi. They fell in love and they got married. And for many, many years, they ran essentially a Communist Party salon into the 1950s. So all the leading left intellectuals in England, Eric Hobsbawm, Christopher Hill and so on, they'd all come to this house and they'd talk and they'd debate. And my grandma was an incredible cook. So even during rationing, she would feed them these big meals and they would make whatever food they had last. And then they grew very disillusioned with communism, like so many from that generation. And they reinvented their house as something of a sort of left liberal salon. And people like Eric Hobsbawm got traded out for people like Isaiah Berlin. And so you had this new cast of characters.
Like a football sticker album of left-wing intelligentsia.
Kind of. And actually, the football sticker thing, I mean, Shimon, in letters to other obsessive collectors, he very much treated his crown jewels, the rarest rare books, like football or baseball cards, and he would trade them out. So there's this extraordinary correspondence with this Italian economist, Piero Schraffer, who was at Trinity College, Cambridge, and was the only other person in England who was as obsessed with socialist memorabilia as Shimon. And I found these letters where they'd say, well, you know, you're Lenin for my Marx. And they would literally trade each other out. And some of these things, you know, in their time were worth a fortune. It's a little bit like the Dutch tulip mania. Yeah. Now, you know, a few hundred years ago, tulips in Amsterdam suddenly were worth an absolute fortune. And everybody wanted them, and then suddenly they weren't. And I think in some ways, Shimon's obsession with Marxist memorabilia was like that. In the 1950s and 60s, that stuff was worth a fortune. By the end of his life, it was a curiosity item. But he would trade books that were worth a year's salary with Schraffer. It was absolutely extraordinary.
It's amazing. And tell us about the atmosphere there in that house then, next to Hampstead Heath. Because lots of when you think of bookish people, you often think of quiet people. It sounds also, as much as your grandfather was obsessed with the manuscript, he was obsessed with all the people that he spoke to and with at this salon. He was obviously describing a lot of words in the air as well.
Yeah, I mean, on one level, Shimon was so obsessed with the world of books that I think if he'd been left to his own devices, he could have become a bit like the character in, there's an Elias Canetti novel, and it's called Auto da Fe. And it's about this obsessed book collector who ends up literally walling himself into a house of books. And he never goes out again. He's just surrounded by the world of ideas and then eventually vanishes into his piles of books. And if you looked at Hillway, you could actually see the outlines of that house. Every single wall, floor to ceiling, double stacked with books, piles of books on the tables, piles of books on the floor. But the thing was, Shimon was always very gregarious and social, but it was my grandmother who made a point of opening the house up. And I say salon, but in a way that sounds too formal. It was a free-for-all. So you could knock on the door any time of day or night. You didn't have to have announced in advance you were going to come. And whatever the time of day was, Mimi would feed you. She'd bring you in and she'd not listen to your protestations that you'd already eaten three or four meals that day. And she'd give you a plate of roast duck and potatoes and all these creamy desserts that she cooked. And she just wouldn't take no when it came to food. And she also wouldn't really take no if you said, well, you know, I've just popped in for 5 minutes, because she assumed you were going to stay the evening. And if you came from out of town, she absolutely assumed that you were going to stay the night. And so when I was a kid, and I had spent a lot of weekends there, I'd go from West London, where I lived with my family, to North London to spend time with my grandparents. And you could almost be guaranteed that there'd be this sort of kaleidoscopic mix of people from all over the world speaking this babble of tongues, sleeping on whatever chair or bed was available. And there really was no formality to it. And so it was this continual evolution, this continual sort of mixing and remixing of people and ideas. And I mean, frankly, I can't think of another house in London remotely similar to that. I think that bizarre mixture of the obsession with book collecting and the obsession with people mixing, people collecting, it made it just an absolute one of a kind. And so all over the world today, you can find people who regard Hillway. You just mentioned the word Hillway and they know you're talking about my grandparents' house and their face lights up. And it's absolutely extraordinary.
But tell me, there is a bit in the book where you're being, you know, obviously very generous to your grandfather. But you say there were other people who wrote and said, can I come and see something in the collection? And he was very much, no. You're not coming to my house. I don't want to show you what I've got. This is my world. Just tell us a little bit about that.
He was extraordinarily generous if he felt that you'd given reason to trust him. So if you were going to Hillway and you showed respect and you showed you cared about the ideas and you were willing to partake in the conversation, you'd sort of be inducted room by room. So you'd come into this bizarre hallway, which was really just a tunnel of books. And the first stopping point would be the kitchen. And you'd go in and Mimi would prepare a cup of tea or Shimon would prepare a cup of coffee. That was sort of the division of labor. And you'd get offered some biscuits and you'd sit and talk. And if you pass muster, you'd be invited to stay. You'd end up having dinner. And if you participated in the conversation, well, it was fairly likely that you'd then get invited back. And then you'd start seeing other rooms. So depending on your interests, if you were really interested in socialist history, you'd end up in Shimon and Mimi's bedroom because it was this absolutely bizarre citadel, all the most incredibly rare socialist material going back hundreds and hundreds of years was stacked on bookshelves literally surrounding the marital bed.
That was the Holy Grail.
Grail. But if you were interested in Jewish history instead, you'd end up in the upstairs front room and he'd ceremoniously unlock the glass doors and start bringing out Kabbalistic documents and rare 17th century manuscripts or very, very early 16th century printed books from places like Constantinople or Antwerp or Mantua. And you'd gradually start being sort of inducted into this world of ideas. And he was very generous. As soon as you'd gained his trust and as soon as he felt there was mutual respect, he would show you anything. But if you just phoned or emailed, well, not emailed, he never used a computer. If you phoned or wrote him a letter out of the blue and just said, I've heard on the grapevine that you have William Morris's original woodcuts, which he did have, or something like that, he would get very, very curt because he'd felt he was being exploited. And he did. He sent these curt letters back saying, absolutely not. It's mine. It's private. And the implication was very clear. You want to come to Hillway, you've got to do it the proper way. And that involves, you know, this journey through this wondrous house that I just talked about.
And did he welcome sort of all imposters just the same in terms of politics and geography and all the rest of it? You could obviously sort of pass go and not collect the £200 in the kitchen and go to one of the other rooms. Would that depend on your political persuasion or just the fact that you're interesting or not?
I think by the time I came on the scene, my grandparents were in their 60s and 70s and they were very tolerant, liberal, absolutely cultured, sophisticated people, and they were much more concerned with the fact that you were interesting and interested than what your politics were. And, you know, most people who came through the house then were liberal or left, but they certainly had a number of conservative friends, and it was the quality of your thought that mattered. But the more I researched my book, the more I realized, it's funny when, as a grandchild, you see your grandparents and they're old, and you see them as always having been old. And of course, they weren't. They were young once, and they had views of young people and, you know, the follies of young people. And the more I researched my book, the more I realized that when they were very young and they were in the Communist Party, and they were very active, they weren't just passive party members. They were, my granddad especially, was quite senior in various committees. And the more I researched, the more I realized they were actually quite dogmatic, or maybe take out the word quite, they were really dogmatic in the late 30s through to the mid 50s. And I found a lot of materials that my granddad had written under various pseudonyms. And I think he wrote in pseudonyms because his father, who was the most senior rabbi in England, was working in one area of East London, and Shimon was working not too far down the street on his Communist Party politics. They were sort of circling each other uneasily. And I think he wanted to spare his father a little bit of embarrassment. So he wrote a lot of his Communist Party propaganda, really, under pseudonyms. And I read some of it in archives in various places around England when I was researching the book, and I was absolutely staggered by how dogmatic he was as a young adult.
And didn't recognise that dogmatism in the older man that was your grandfather.
I mean, I knew my granddad was deeply, deeply both ashamed and also embarrassed by some of the views of his youth. And he'd never really fully reconciled himself with the fact that, I mean, a lot of people were communists. I don't think there was anything to be ashamed of being a communist. But the fact that he had defended Stalin in particular, and the fact that he hadn't believed the stories of the terror and all these other things. And, you know, Shimon's father had actually been imprisoned by Stalin. The reason they left Russia was Shimon's father had done time in Siberia in a hard labor camp. But Shimon nevertheless had become very involved in Marxist ideology and had thought the future lay with the Soviet Union. So he really was very rigid. And one of the things I had to wrestle with as a writer is, you know, obviously to tell this story, even though these are my grandparents that I'm talking about, and I love them as much or more than anyone I've ever loved in my life, but to tell the story, it couldn't be a hagiography. It had to be a sort of warts and all thing. And that, for me as a writer, was just, you know, it was this massive, massive struggle. How do I make my grandparents as young adults three-dimensional? And I hope I've done it in the book, but it certainly made me appreciate that they had various incarnations and that to just think of them as these gentle, elderly people, it really didn't do full justice to the, you know, they lived almost a century. In my granddad's case, he lived to be 93 years old. And I had to understand him over all of that time.
He is a historian with an archaeologist's brush as he dusts off 20,000 books. Sasha, lovely speaking to you. That was Sasha Abramsky, author of The House of 20,000 Books.
Thank you.
Our next guest has written a highly entertaining guide to the pervasive influence of money on the American political system. It's been called the book that has Washington aflutter. It's a gonzo-style tome which has our author getting kicked out of hotels and events, getting physically threatened, and which features a motley cast of characters from Texas trial lawyers and Hollywood execs to casino magnates. The book is called Big Money, $2.5 million, One Suspicious Vehicle, and A Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. And the author is Kenneth Vogel, a reporter for Politico. Kenneth, welcome to the programme. And first of all, was there an alarm bell that sounded in your head that made you want to write this book?
Yeah, absolutely, Robin. Thanks for having me. The big donors and big money have sort of always had a part in American politics. But what I saw changing and what I thought warranted book treatment was that these big donors were becoming even bigger. They were giving more and more money, and they were having just a greater and greater impact on both the electoral process and the policymaking process. Starting roughly about 2010, there was a U.S. Supreme Court decision that loosened the rules, but it was also, there were a number of decisions that led up to it, and it was almost more of a landscape shift that was a little bit of like a mental and emotional shift, where these big donors who once sort of felt some qualms about writing these enormous checks to influence elections no longer did. They no longer felt threatened by the possibility of legal scrutiny, and they no longer felt like it was somehow frowned upon. It became the new normal, and that's what I tried to capture with this book.
And maybe we can explore then how well donorship works, if you know what I mean, like how much influence a certain amount of money will get you and quite how bad that is potentially for the political process in the US.
Yeah, there's certainly a tendency, Rob, for people to look at the last presidential election, 2012, which was the first election in this new big money era after the Citizens United decision, and say the biggest spenders, those being Republicans, conservatives, people supporting Mitt Romney, did not get their way. They lost. They spent over $1 billion. And, you know, as Karl Rove, sort of the leading figure in the conservative Republican big money world, was asked on election night after he had that famous meltdown where he sort of denied that the election had gone to Barack Obama on live TV. He was asked on Fox News, what did it all get you? It seems like it was all down the drain. He said, of course, being very much on the defensive, well, the election would have been a lot different. It would have been more of a blowout had we not spent all that money. But I think you could almost argue that some of the big spending on the Republican side, at least, kind of backfired, at least in the Republican presidential primary process, where you had, in some cases, just a single sugar daddy who was able to keep a candidate, a rival to Mitt Romney, alive in the primary for much longer than they would have otherwise been able to keep running against Mitt Romney, and kind of ultimately weakened him as a general election candidate, sent him sort of limping into the general election against Barack Obama. And it was because these rogue billionaires, Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul who supported Newt Gingrich's campaign, his campaign for the Republican nomination against Mitt Romney, and Foster Freeze, another guy who supported Rick Santorum, reforms campaign, they just refused to be talked down. And in this new Wild West environment, no one could stop them. They were sort of parties unto themselves. And so their spending did have a huge effect, just not the one that they intended.
And you mentioned sugar daddies there. That's one of the vibes of the book, Kenneth, that this is a little bit of a murky world. It's paid and kind of, you know, get the comeuppance afterwards. Are these guys sugar daddies, or do they see themselves as philanthropists?
Yeah, they see themselves as philanthropists and even more so as political investors. And a lot of it does have the feel of sort of an investment where these folks expect some return on that investment. And when you spend all that money and don't win the election, again, there's a tendency to think, well, it had no impact. But I don't think you have to look a whole lot further than the 2013 federal government shutdown in the United States, where Republican members of Congress refused to vote to continue funding the government, refused to vote to raise the debt ceiling. And that, I think, was a direct result of these members of Congress no longer needing the political party itself, the Republican Party, and the good graces of the leadership of the Republican Party, because they didn't need the Republican Party's money to get reelected. Rather, the money that they needed to get reelected was from these political investors, these sugar daddies like the Koch brothers, the conservative billionaire industrialist from Kansas in the United States. They really had a great impact on turning the Republican Party to the right, at least on fiscal measures. And though they didn't win the presidency in 2012, they arguably in the last few election cycles have done more to shape the course of American policymaking, at least on fiscal issues, than the parties themselves.
And this is obviously a big power game. I mean, it's less maybe like a chess game than a football game, Kenneth. But I wondered whether these guys, these donors, we've called them a rogues gallery. I think it says it in your book, but it certainly says it in our introduction. Rather maybe than what the donors are like, what are the politicians and the consultants like with the donors? Are they ushering around a very rich art investor? I mean, these guys' livelihoods depend on these donors, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. And they are extremely solicitous. And even more than that, they are willing to take positions that don't necessarily comport with either the best interests of the party or the best interest of their constituents, because they think that they are the positions that the big donors want them to take. So we see instances where you have Foster Freeze, who is the donor who I talked about, who supported Rick Santorum's presidential campaign. He was really taken with this idea that the threat of Islamofascism was somehow the driving issue in the 2012 presidential campaign. So he is literally riding around shotgun with Rick Santorum in the run-up to the Iowa caucuses, funding the super PAC that is supporting Rick Santorum, and the super PAC is airing ads encouraging voters to vote for Rick Santorum instead of Mitt Romney, because Rick Santorum is the guy who's going to clamp down on Islamofascism. Well, these voters in Iowa, in the heartland of America, are more concerned with the price of ethanol subsidies and the Obamacare, their own health care, the economy. And really, Islamofascism is pretty far down the list, but no one is willing to tell Foster Freeze no, because he's the guy who is funding the campaign, and without him, the campaign is going nowhere. So suddenly you see this discussion of Islamofascism out in the middle of Iowa, and it's very discordant, and I think it traces directly back to the influence of these big donors, and one big donor in particular, who no one was willing to say no to.
That's the thing, isn't it? I guess that's one of the other factors, that some of these donors are men, they're mostly men, that are amazing at making $5 billion or more, and they've got that sort of ready money to pump into a campaign, maybe making paperclips, maybe flipping burgers on a huge scale, whatever it might be. But their political ideas are phenomenally childish and childlike sometimes, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I compare it to sports team owners. These are folks who, in both cases, the mega donors and the sports team owners, who have made a ton of money and usually have done so through business acumen, through effectively gauging the trend lines in a given industry, whether it's oil or whether it's hedge funds or whether it's software. And so they have come to really trust their instincts and trust their gut because they have made their fortunes, in some cases, bucking conventional wisdom. And so once they spend their fortunes on all the, you know, vacation homes and corporate jets and yachts, and once they've given the donations that have put their names on the sides of all the museums and hospitals and academic institutions in their hometowns, it's like, what's next for them? Well, if you're a sports junkie, maybe you go and plunk down $2 billion for a sports team. And maybe when the coach or the GM, the general manager, tells you, well, I don't think it's a great strategy for us to be constantly throwing the long bomb in the case of football. You know, I think we should focus on our running game. And you're the owner and you're the one who's writing the checks to pay the players. And you tell them, no. I've been following sports for years and years. Don't try to tell me how to run this team. I'm the one who, you know, made all the money and was so successful to be able to buy this team. And it's very difficult to tell these folks no. I talked, and same thing with the political mega donors. I talked to a very close advisor to Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas casino mogul, who was spending all this money. He ended up spending $20 million during the Republican presidential primary in 2012 trying to elect Newt Gingrich president. And even as this was going on and the super PAC that he was funding was airing all these ads that were really aggressively beating up Mitt Romney in a way that left him vulnerable to President Obama's subsequent attacks, these folks were going to Sheldon Adelson and telling him, Sheldon, I know you really like Newt Gingrich. I know you have this loyalty thing. I know you think he'd be a great president, but you're really hurting the party. You're hurting Mitt Romney. You need to stand down. And I had one of his advisors who actually tried to make that case tell me, you know, billionaires are not always the best listeners. So it's that way with sports. It's that way with politics.
All right, Kenneth. Well, thank you very much for your time. That was Kenneth Vogel, the author of Big Money. And that's it for edition 265 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew.
And it was a very nice one indeed.
Yeah, I like it. It had an ebb and flow about it. We tackled some big themes, but luckily we also had Tom Edwards' news look ahead. To sort of, you know, it's like you have people come in and they go, yeah, I'm Howard French. I'm the guy from Political. I've written this book. Do I have all these big wigs in? I think when they listen back to that show, they go, oh, tell us when it's on. We go, here they are. And we get feedback, don't we? But we don't ever get that much feedback on Tom Edwards' news look ahead, which itself is a thing of light and shade.
Spitting seeds across the room.
Spitting seeds across the room. Maybe why we need to combine the two light elements of the show, pre-match banter and Tom Edwards' new look ahead. Yes, we can get llamas to spit seeds into the water jug.
I wonder if Tom Edwards has been invited round to the Abramsky's house and he's trying to pass, you know, the test game from the first room. He'd have been in that kitchen spitting Miriam's seeds across the room. I don't think he'd have got to room two.
I don't think he would have done. I think he might have, yeah, exactly. Sort of crunched biscuits into the sofa. Sorry, I didn't know there was a plate of biscuits on the sofa. Crunch.
Didn't mean to sit on your hobnobs. Sorry.
And on that note, should we thank the people behind the glass, our friends? Should we thank Claire Urban, who's the studio manager?
And I'll thank Daniel Giacopelli.
And is it going to be? It's not going to be the same time, same place next week because I'm going to be on holiday. So I'm not going to be. You're going to have to hold the.
I'm going to be here.
Hold the plate of hobnobs on your own, Andrew. I don't want anything to do with it.
I wouldn't mind a custard cream either. Anyway, we are going to be back next week, but without Rob. But stay around.
But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.